From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Electronics retailer Circuit City files for bankruptcy. It's just some of the tough news for big companies, but how are small business owners doing in this climate as well? And how much can the president-elect do for the economy before he takes office? Keith Reed is here with the latest on our finances. He's a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and he blogs at Keith Reed's Money Corner. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Farai. How's it going?
Great. Let's go straight to the top. Senator Obama held his first press conference as president-elect on Friday. Here's part of what he had to say.
We are going to need to see a stimulus package passed either before or after inauguration. We are going to have to focus on jobs because the hemorrhaging of jobs has an impact, obviously, on consumer confidence and the ability of people to buy goods and services, and can have enormous spillover effects.
Stimulus, 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 bailout, bailout. At this point, what are we really talking about in terms of proposed action?
Well, it's hard to say what direction the new administration is going to go in. It's also largely that's going to depend on what happens with the lame duck administration between now and January 19th. I think one of the parts of the clip that we didn't get to hear was that the president-elect wants to see a stimulus package passed before he gets in the office. But if it's not, if one is not passed by the time he gets in the office, then he's essentially saying, you know, what doesn't get done, I'll do myself. But we don't know what the current administration is going to do. We don't know what Congress is going to put on the table just yet. There are two possibilities among many that come to the front of mind. I think if you take the current administration's previous approaches to stimulus, what we've seen is direct stimulus going straight to the taxpayer, coming from Treasury, the IRS saying, listen, you know, here we're gonna give you back some of the money that you would have otherwise paid in taxes, and you'll get a $300 or $600 check. It's very, very questionable at that point what that would do to stimulate the economy. If you take a look back at the track record of the previous stimulus checks that people have gotten from the Bush administration, didn't keep us out of recession. Didn't keep the economy going, and so now you're going in and asking for that to happen again. It's dubious.
Let me just jump in, because we have to talk about the job situation. 240,000 jobs lost nationwide in October alone. Mm-hmm. 1.2 million so far this year, and it was also the worst month for retailers since 1971. Circuit City today, one of the places that people head to buy their holiday gifts, is filing for bankruptcy. On top of that, DHL, the shipper, says it's cutting nearly 10,000 jobs and basically ending its domestic-only shipping. So that means a lot of people are going to enter the holiday season with a lot of stress and with a heavy heart. I understand that DHL has a large number of jobs in your area. Is that right?
DHL has its main, its biggest hub operation in Wilmington, Ohio, which is not far from Cincinnati. It's a very small town. About 12,000 people live in Wilmington. It's unclear at this point how many of these new jobs that are going to be cut will be coming from Wilmington. Also in northern Kentucky at the airport. Cincinnati's airport is actually just across the river in northern Kentucky. There are several hundred people who work at an air hub for DHL. The DHL actually shares with another shipping company over in northern Kentucky. It remains to be seen how many of those jobs are going to be lost out. But I was at a meeting of some economic development officials from Cincinnati and northern Kentucky just over an hour ago, and they are tremendously worried not only about the prospects for job losses from DHL, but also overall that many of the economists that they're consulting with say that that overall this is probably not going to end. And when I say this, I mean the overall economic strife, job losses, contraction of the economy probably will not end before late in 2009, if not more than 18 months out from now. So this is very likely, by all indications, to be pretty protracted and not just painful this holiday season, but into next year, deep into next year.
You know, there has been a lot of question about where jobs are going to come from, and when you talk about the black community, you're talking about a community where we really have double the unemployment rate of the national. You're talking about for black men, specifically, 11% unemployment rate. So we had an advisor to Senator Obama, Corey Elans, on the show last week, and he talked about the administration expanding opportunities for urban folks, young urban folks, in environmentalism-related or green jobs.
One of the main things he's talked about is developing green jobs, developing jobs based on this new economy that's going to come about because of our new look at the environment, in addition to our energy policy as well. That's actually been one of the main staples of his urban policy, is to take a look at how we can change and redevelop our urban communities by developing jobs, making them more greener, and making them more accessible to more people in the community.
So when you think about your area, Ohio, Kentucky, all the job losses that are going on right now, do you think that this is something that could work for your area? And if so, what form might green jobs take?
I think it could work for this area. I think it could work for many other urban areas in places, parts of the country where private sector jobs are going away. I think what you're beginning to hear, and this goes back to your original question of what form stimulus will come in, I really think that what you're starting to hear from President-elect Obama's administration is that they is sort of the beginnings of potentially a new deal, where we're going to step forward. The country is going to step forward. The administration will step forward and propose many new infrastructure projects, many new projects that will put people to work on either on the government's dole or incentivize companies to transform their own industries. Because one of the problems that you have right now is that if you rely on the private sector doesn't have the money to hire anybody right now. That's why you see all these job losses. That's why you don't see expansion. And so the only way to really get people moving, to get companies moving in the direction of hiring again, is to put forth these infrastructure kinds of projects, so to give companies new incentive to move in the direction of, for example, green jobs. What that ultimately means, I mean, if you look at here in Ohio, there's been a proposal on the table for several years to improve transportation by building a new high-speed rail system throughout the state. We know that can't happen without federal government money. Right now might be a good time for the state of Ohio to go to for cities like Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, Akron, Toledo, to be going to the federal government and say, listen, we've got this plan already in place. Rail transportation is cleaner, it's more efficient, and building this thing out would get some people who are on the unemployment dole right now off the unemployment dole and put them to work. I think you'll start to see those sorts of projects crop up in states requesting that kind of money, in the Obama administration really looking at projects like that that are both environmentally friendly and would put a lot of people to work in the next couple of years.
What about small businesses? Is there any help on the way for them?
We haven't heard specifically what kind of help is going to be on the way for small businesses. I mean, of course, many of them are in trouble. I think the unfortunate thing is that they're going to continue to be in trouble. You know, again, at this meeting that I was at, one of the things that was discussed and that economic development officials, at least here in my area, are concerned with is that over the past, in past recessions, when the economy has contracted like this, you saw it was typically good for small businesses, or at least for small and new business creation, because what happens, people lose jobs, and that opens up the opportunity for them to do what they've wanted to do for quite some time. The difference is, at least anecdotally this time around, is that you are not seeing, as more and more people lose jobs, you haven't begun to see people gain an uptick in self-employment. And that is very, very troublesome. It could mean that people are having greater problems accessing the capital that they need. It could mean that they just don't have the money saved for a rainy day that would allow them to do that. Or it could just mean that the economy is so bad that there's not enough flow of capital, even at the very, very micro levels, that would allow somebody who would have otherwise been an entrepreneur to do business effectively. And that's definitely something that's going to have to be addressed. How the Obama administration does that is not something that I think is clear yet.
You talked about a sort of new deal, which is something that would make some people very happy and other people ideologically would be opposed to it. We're seeing that the federal government is going to be purchasing more AIG stock. That's, a major company that deals with insurance. And there already was a $60 billion line of credit that was part of the bailout, now another $40 billion. Will that erode the possibility that there is money for a new deal? Just quickly.
I think that's possible. But really what happened here was that they didn't add money to AIG's bailout. What they did was kind of refinance the refinancing. They lent AIG some money, and AIG came back and said, listen, we can't make the payments on this loan. We need a longer term over which to pay, and we need a better interest rate, and that's what the government did. And they also went back in and said, instead of lending you as much money as we had at onerous terms, we're going to buy more AIG shares and use that as a way to make a direct investment in the company and give you the capital that you need as opposed to lending.
Just one quick follow-up. When you think about what is going to help homeowners and individuals, are we hearing anything more about anything direct to homeowners?
I haven't, not in the last several weeks. I haven't heard anything about more direct stimulus for homeowners. I think it's going to become clear as we get closer to the end of the year what sorts of things, what form a new stimulus package is going to look at. And I think it will really include, it's going to have to include some of all of the elements that we just discussed. More clarity on what we're doing for Wall Street, more clarity on what's happening for the homeowner, more clarity on what's going to happen for the business owner. All of that is going to become more and more clear now that we know who will be running the next administration.
All right, Keith, thank you.
Thanks, Farai.
That was Keith Reed of the Cincinnati Inquirer. He joined us from WVXU in Cincinnati, Ohio. And just ahead, President-elect Obama gives his first big apology, all on bloggers. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Reverend Jeremiah Wright says the media tried to use him to take down candidate Barack Obama. The Republican Party lashes out against Sarah Palin. And is Obama the worst thing that's happened to comedians? Our bloggers are here to give us their take. We've got Christopher Rabb, founder of the blog AfroNetizen.com. He is also a Netroots activist. Sharon Toomer, founder and managing editor of BlackandBrownNews.com. And Ron Scott, who blogs for TheDetroitNews.com. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
All right, let's start out with Reverend Wright. He is back in the news. So he's former pastor of President-elect Barack Obama. And last week he was on a panel about race and religion at a Connecticut church. And here's how he looked back at how the media treated him and Obama.
What I say or don't say, it is not an index in terms of what Senator Obama believed or believes. The media did not want that sermon heard. Their intention was to use me as a weapon of mass destruction to destroy that man's candidacy.
So first, Barack Obama distanced himself from the Reverend after reporters started playing videos of Reverend Wright using a phrase that included "Damn America." Then Wright made another major controversial speech, and Senator Obama actually repudiated him. And this is the man, Reverend Wright, that is, who married the senator and his wife. So Wright is saying that the media tried to destroy Obama's candidacy using him as a weapon. Sharon, do you think he's right about this? And do you think that reporters made the right decisions in how they used the tape of Reverend Wright?
First, I hate that those two were put in that position. I mean, the relationship between a pastor and a congregant is very sacred. So I can only imagine what they went through from that perspective. What I do think, Farai, is that if for no other reason than the media or reporters or, you know, the editorial decision-making was to just beat the story in the ground, I did think that it was overkill on it. And it wasn't until the Reverend Wright went from a very rational Bill Moyers interview to an impassioned speech in Detroit. I think it was the NAACP.
Yep.
To
yes, it
the
was.
Monday... To Monday, where he just sounded irrational and just no clear thought process, where he just really gave the easy out. But up to then, I just remember turning on the news and being sick of hearing it myself. That doesn't mean they shouldn't have reported on it at all. I think it was relevant, but to the extent that they covered it, I thought that they that it was reported. It was overkill in reporting.
And I just want to jump in on this because here in Detroit, Reverend Wright got a 100,000 people who came out to see him at the NAACP dinner. That 100,000 people and the comments that they made were not covered to the same degree that this was covered. I think this is a reflection of a real problem, which I see when you talk about the media. We have to talk about, you know, certain corporate media and what their biases are and what they wanted to achieve and how they projected this story. I think, Dan Rather said it at a discussion at the National Press Club the other day. He said, we're looking at views as opposed to news. And essentially, that's what they did. And essentially, Reverend Wright, whom I respect a whole lot, essentially became a caricaturistic fall guy for this whole situation. And I just think it was a reflection of what...
But it just wasn't... Right. It wasn't just the conservative media. It was media in general. I mean, you'd have anchors or, you know, whoever was hosting the
show. I'm not speaking
shows.
Just about conservatives.
Okay.
I'm speaking about individuals in the media who essentially had a feeding frenzy on this particular story.
Absolutely.
Because it seemed to be sexy and hot and strong.
Right.
And essentially raised all of the images of race and racism that you could think of. And plus, the question about anti-Americanism was raised. And it raises a more significant point. How much should candidates be judged by virtue of what their association is with various people? In fact, Bill Clinton had taken a picture with Reverend Wright. I mean, should that had made a difference in terms of how you viewed Hillary?
Let me get Chris
in
here.
I was just going to say that the irony is that William Ayers is arguably more anti-American than anyone because he actually stated as such in his heyday, so to speak. And yet he got a pass for most of the campaign until the Republicans got very desperate. But because he had the validation of white liberal and Republican elites, because he's part of the mainstream in Chicago.
Right, exactly.
He was socially acceptable because he comes from wealth and is a personally very wealthy person who had been redeemed. And that was not the case for Reverend Wright, who did not have the same access and the same validation. And honestly, if it's about the merits, why aren't we talking about Hagee?
Well, Chris, let me jump in here, Chris, and just get your quick opinion on another part of this issue. Some political analysts are actually saying that Senator McCain blew a chance by not focusing more on Reverend Wright. Now, you had folks, including the Pennsylvania Republican Party, really going full bore and doing ads with Reverend Wright, kind of looking all washed out and scary. But in slow motion, but you did not have the McCain campaign directly using Reverend Wright in the last days of the campaign. Do you think purely
I'm in Pennsylvania, so
yeah.
He did.
Well,
I saw it all the time.
Well, but the thing
the
is,
time,
there's a distinction between who pays for the ads, which is why you see at the end of these campaign ads, or why we saw, you know, I'm Barack Obama or I'm John McCain and I approve this message. Do you think that the McCain campaign actually, from a tactical standpoint, could have made more hay about Reverend Wright and it would have changed the outcome in Pennsylvania?
No. I don't think so at all, because the reality is that the voters he was going after were swing voters, independents, so-called undecideds, and those folks, regardless of what level of racism one might ascribe to them, they're interested in the economy. They're interested in what's going on in their backyard, and regardless of where they land on social issues, racial issues, they're worried about a job. They're worried about foreclosures. That's what they're worried about. And all the studies show that they are the least responsive to negative ads. So just, practically speaking, it wouldn't have reached them. It reaches the base. It always reaches the base well, but these are not the base.
Well, here's the upside to that media saturation, and that is by the time it got around to McCain, it had been, beaten to the ground that they were worried about those other pressing issues. So they're probably just
They were tired of it.
Yeah, they're just tired. What else can you say about it?
All right. Well, I actually want to make sure anyone who is just tuning in knows who you guys are for our fabulous Bloggers Roundtable. We were just hearing from Sharon Toomer of blackandbrownnews.com. We've got Ron Scott of thedetroitnews.com and Christopher Rabb of afronetizen.com. I want to move on to a question of what's funny and what's not. Now that Barack Obama is the president-elect, some comedians are complaining that an Obama administration is just not going to be as funny for them as President Bush. Comedian Bill Maher spoke to Larry King about the difficulty comedians have making fun of Barack Obama.
He's not stupid. He's not angry. He's not a phony. He's not fat. He's not cheating on his wife. Who needs a jerk like that around for the next 4 years? I mean, come on. But look, he's going to be the president, and we're going to have to get over our nervousness about making fun of a black person. He's not a black person. He's the president.
All right, Sharon, there's an article in TheRoot.com by Salamisha Tillett that said that mainstream American comedy basically has been segregated, and there's these different ideas of how you might deal with a black person. A white comedian might have different rules in dealing with a black person, let alone the black president. Regardless of whether you think it's race or whether you think it's that Barack Obama is just not funny enough to poke fun at, do you think it's a good time for humor? Folks had a lot of fun with Sarah Palin, or were very mean to her, depending on your point of view. What about Barack Obama?
Well, as president, I think he's fair game for comedians. I think the challenge is what the writer and the is Shalamisha a male or female? I'm not sure.
She's a woman, academic.
She's a woman. Thank you. And she made a good point that perhaps they need to step up their game in terms of nuance. I mean, they have not probably been exposed to many blacks like the Obamas. And I'm sure it's not represented in their writing staff or producing staff. And I would say that was with SNL during this campaign season as well. So I think the onus is going to be on them to dig a little deeper. They've been, you know, fortunate with low-hanging fruit with stereotypes, but now they're just going to have to, you know, do some research and bring on people who can help them make fun of the president in a way that's...
Well, stereotypes are a really good point of reference, too, though. I wrote a piece about how Barack Obama needs to travel with a basketball in hand, even when he's talking about foreign policy, because he, you know, he's not a bowler. And I basically wrote an article on my blog that he needs to just play basketball, because that's a stereotype. That's a good stereotype that will work for him as a candidate. It may work for him as a president, too. I think there's going to be a lot of leverage around stuff like that.
But do you think that if you were white and had written that all of a sudden you would be tarred and feathered?
No, because there are a ton of white comedians who talk about black folk.
I think really the situation is that, as was said before, you know, you don't have the writers who are doing this. I can think of one person right now, not necessarily a white person, but a Latino, who probably will make a lot of fun of Barack Obama, and that's probably Carlos Mencia, because he makes fun of everybody. I mean, nobody is sacred, and nothing is sacred. And I think he's extremely funny. I think Bill Maher and a number of other people suffer from white liberal disease. They essentially do not think that they can criticize black people, and they really work hard to make sure that they don't say the wrong thing. And the minute that a comedian does that, let's face it, comedians, according to Mark Twain and others, really are a reflection of the social jester. They essentially have to ferret out and critique that which is the country, and make a standard essentially in relationship to analyzing what these people are doing. And I just think that if Barack Obama's candidacy and subsequent presidency makes history, then the next level of history will be how we record these things, how we analyze them. So, you know, I'm having these challenges in terms of writing about various things in terms of what white liberal media, comedians, and everybody else, how they respond to African Americans now. I've written several things about about that. So I think they just have to get over it, so to speak, and try to do what their job is, which is to be social critics.
And what about black comedians? Do you think black comedians are going to do better? Because I'm thinking about the fact that David Alan Greer has this new show, Chocolate News. We just spoke to him recently, and we're going to speak to D.L. Hughley, who has kind of, you know, a funny news talk show, or, you know, news talk show with humor as opposed to a sketch comedy show, which is Chocolate News. But do you think, Chris, that this is just it's going to be a good time for black comedians or not so much? Or,
well, I think it will be there'll be more material for black comedians because they will have more leeway to talk about these issues. But it's going to be harder for it's going to be easier for good comedians. It's going to be harder for bad black comedians because the bad comedians, period, they lack nuance. They do not know how to filter complexity. Yeah. And Obama is a uniquely complex individual in a transformative moment in our culture. So to talk about him as a traditional black person is not going to work. Are we going to paint the White House black? And those types of that type of message is not going to resonate as well because the journey to the White House has been so circuitous and with such great nuance that a good comedian, I think Jon Stewart actually, who's not black, but he did a great one when he said, well, your mother was white and your father's African, so when you went in to vote because of the Bradley effect, did you keep yourself from voting? And Obama cracked up. Obama cracked up. He loved it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the type of thing that needs to be explored by good comedians.
Okay, well, we're on to a speed round. There's a couple more things that I want to just bring up really quickly. One of them is that during his first press conference as president-elect, it appears the senator was struck with a case of foot-and-mouth disease. He cracked a joke about Nancy Reagan.
In terms of speaking to former presidents, I've spoken to all of them that are living, obviously. President Clinton. I didn't want to get into a Nancy Reagan thing about, you know, doing any seances.
Now, she did not do seances, although she has visited astrologers. Different. But nonetheless, this is a woman who is quite ill right now, and the president called her to apologize and said that everything's copacetic. President-elect. So is it kind of good that he at least got one gaffe out of the way?
Absolutely.
Yeah, tell me more.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, absolutely. It's going to happen. We've got four at least, and there will be more. And it was a good response to it before it got out of hand. He made the important call to Nancy Reagan and apologized. But I just can't imagine him being even as president, not making a few inappropriate remarks.
I just wanted to raise that because I think that, you know, a number of people have various expectations of Barack Obama. It was just like, you know, a friend of mine here did she has a choir, and the choir was scheduled to sing on the night of the election. And so they wanted to have choir rehearsal, and so they said, Obama trumps choir rehearsal. And so she wrote an email. She said, is Obama more important than choir rehearsal? Can he walk on water? The person sent it back and said, maybe. And I think a lot of people are expecting Barack Obama not to make mistakes. I mean, he's a human being. He's a person that's dealing with a very complex international job. And this was just one of them. And I think it was really, really minutia.
And hey, I think we're going to see the first.
I actually want you to take the last question of the speed round on a different topic. Since Senator McCain lost his bid for the presidency, the GOP has gone on the attack against Governor Palin and said some people have said that she's the reason that John McCain lost. And they've talked about the fact that apparently she doesn't know that Africa is a continent and not a country. But is this
it's an archipelago, I thought.
There's all sorts of peninsulas, et cetera, et cetera. But look, is this basically kind of putting just, you know, trying to cast blame on someone else when there were supposedly a bunch of deciders making decisions about who would be on the ticket? Just quickly, is this...
Right, well, I hear, you know, different camps saying, well, she's uniquely unqualified to be a vice president or president. And I also hear that there is tremendous sexism in mainstream media and these political campaigns. And they're all right. They're all right. I think they would have gone about it much differently if she were a man. I do think sexism is rampant, but I also think that she is she's not a particularly bright or intellectually curious person. And right. And I think we're talking about sour grapes by a bunch of men primarily. Mm. But right. I do think that the fact that she has been so ascendant in such a short period of time also talks about what advantages she had as a candidate in ways that, I mean, if this were a person of color, I mean, we wouldn't.
All right. Well, we're going to have to end it there. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We were talking to Chris Rabb, founder of AfroNetizen, who joined us from WHYY in Philadelphia, Sharon Toomer of blackandbrownnews.com from WNYC in New York, Ron Scott of thedetroitnews.com from WJLB in Detroit. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. As President-elect Barack Obama surveys the political landscape and plans his formal rise to power, plenty of black politicians across the country are looking to see how they fit into the picture. Powerful African Americans inside and outside of government have helped hold U.S. presidents accountable for dealing with issues from civil rights to job creation. We have with us a couple of people who are going to really look and analyze the situation. Sherrilyn Ifill is a civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School, and Professor Eddie Glaude, Jr., Professor of Religion and African American Studies at Princeton University. Welcome, guys.
Happy to be here.
So let me start with you, Sherrilyn. There's this question of whether or not there is going to be essentially a hall pass given to the Obama administration because he is black, or whether, on the other hand, people are going to have higher expectations and deeper expectations. How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, I think both of those things are going to happen. I think that's perfectly natural, that on one hand, he's going to be subjected to heightened scrutiny because of the expectation that I think quite legitimately many African-Americans feel for someone who has the kind of background and experience that Barack Obama does, and I think for any Democratic president, but certainly for an African-American one. I do think that there is going to be some sense of protectionism that African-Americans feel, not about criticizing Barack Obama necessarily, but about how people do it. So I think there's going to be, you know, both of those things happening. But I also think there's going to be a third thing happening. And I think it's reflective of the fact that Barack Obama is not a phenomenon in and of himself. He really is a reflection of the most successful effort of kind of a new set of black leaders who've come on the scene. And I think that some of those black leaders are going to be asking some tough questions of Barack Obama, but in a way that I think is very productive. And I think we're going to see a new kind of dialogue among black leaders happening on the national scene that's fully integrated into the larger conversation that America's having about public policy. And that's what I think is going to be really exciting about this Barack Obama presidency.
Okay, well, we also have with us James Rucker. James, just hold on. I'm going to go to Professor Eddie Glaude, Jr. Do you think that African Americans, since you are a professor of religion and African American studies, do you think that African Americans who are more socially conservative are going to find their place in this administration? And I don't mean in terms of staffing the administration, but I'm thinking about things like the faith-based initiative. Do you think there's going to be room in the Obama era for really trying to please social conservatives?
Well, I don't know so much as President-elect Obama will try to please social conservatives, but he has made it very clear that there's a place for religious commitments in public deliberation. Right? That is to say, President-elect Obama has already made it clear throughout the primary and throughout the national election that he is attentive to the ways in which religious beliefs inform political decision-making. And to the extent to which he has tried to, in some significant way, push the Democratic Party to give more attention to those folk who are in the pews, those folks who are in the mosques and the synagogues, I think he will be open to understanding that churches and synagogues and mosques and other religious institutions will play a central role in addressing the circumstances that the country finds itself in. So to that extent, I think the folks of social conservatives or religious folk will find a friend in President-elect Obama.
James Rucker, Executive Director of ColorOfChange.org, online citizens lobby group. You've worked on any number of campaigns that have really used technology to bring people into the real world, like around GINA 6, but also around the election. Now, when you think about the challenges that this administration is going to face. On the one hand, you may have social conservatives, and many African-American voters may vote Democratic but are also social conservatives. But then you have people who are already talking about the Obama administration information being much too centrist and not seeming to be, you know, simply by the choices of who it's picking for transition teams, et cetera,
sure,
not seeming to be shaping up to be an administration who will take a forceful stand on issues that affect people who really are not in power. So what's your job? How do you construct your job right now as it relates to the administration and as it relates to the constituencies that you've been working with?
Sure. No, I think we're actually on really strong footing. I think a lot of folks wonder, well, you know, how do we go from there to here into the future? What I think is wonderful is that Senator and I guess President-elect Obama has made clear that he understands many of the issues that plague black communities, low-income communities, and actually is interested in and comes from and has an understanding of these communities that usually don't have a voice. Of course, you know, Senator Obama has a country to clean up, several big messes to clean up, and there's no way he's going to be, you know, kind of the candidate who's first and foremost about, say, black issues or the issues of our cities. And I think for us, what it comes down to is a few things. One is certainly holding Obama accountable. I think he is, if you look at his speech on race that he gave after the Jeremiah Wright situation, if you look at some of his speeches between then and now, he speaks to the issues in large part that many Americans face. It so happens that there are certain communities who are on the forefront of the bad stuff, but a lot of the problems that we face are kind of just amplified, an amplification of the problems that we all face.
Well, but James, let me just jump in.
Please.
If you find a situation where you think an Obama administration is really doing poorly by,
yes,
say, young black Americans, would you be willing to have an online action that said, tell President Obama, blah, blah, blah? I mean, are you going to?
Oh, yeah, in a minute. Absolutely. I mean, I think that is part of the role. And, you know, because President-elect Obama happens to be black, really doesn't mean anything in terms of the ways in which we'd hold him accountable. In fact, I think we would be looking to President-elect Obama to, not just kind of fall in line, but to be sensitive and quick to understand the issues we're talking about. So absolutely.
Sherrilyn, do you think that there is going to be a willingness to try to insert less popular policy points? And I'm thinking about things here even during the Clinton administration, issues of the death penalty were very controversial. It doesn't mean just because a Democrat is in office doesn't mean all of a sudden all of these progressive causes get embraced. I mean, how do you think that not just African-American run, but progressive groups will try to interact with an Obama administration?
Well, I think that, as always, there's a split in the progressive, you know, community, and the progressive community is not a monolith. I was actually really happy to hear, you know, James Rucker say what he just said, because I was actually thinking about him and Color of Change and other groups like that who I think will be willing to step to President Obama, in large part because they know he can take it, because he's smart enough and because he's interested enough in, you know, alternative ideas, and because he can be pushed, and because he is steady and he's not going to lash out with a sense of being in some way morally outraged by the fact that people challenge him. So I think his style gives permission for people to be more challenging, as well as his substance. But I also think that within the progressive community, there are those who are pragmatic progressives, you know, and those who are let's have it now progressives. you know, when you heard Ralph Nader the other night on Fox News, you know, talking about, you know, will Obama be an Uncle Tom, that just caught so many people on the raw, progressives as well, because that doesn't strike people as particularly productive. And I think for African Americans, again, who, as I suggested earlier, will be feeling culturally protective of Obama and feeling like he deserves a chance and recognizing the challenges that he's up against, are willing, I think, to demonstrate some pragmatism in the way in which we deploy our efforts to have him address specifically the kinds of concerns that face our community. And I think Obama's shown he's up to the challenge. He's sophisticated enough to recognize the multiple layers that are at work and the ways in which he'll have to deal with different parts of the constituency that ultimately really supports and wants his presidency to do well, but most of all wants to ensure that it produces real returns for the communities that we've worked with and represent.
Okay, I want to make sure that anyone who is just tuning in is aware of who you guys are, and we're talking about basically who's going to hold the Obama administration's feet to the fire among African-American leadership and perhaps other folks. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. That was Sherrilyn Ifill, law professor at the University of Maryland Law School. We've also got Professor Eddie Glaude, Jr., professor of religion and African-American studies at Princeton University, and James Rucker, executive director of colorofchange.org. Professor Glaude, when you look at what's going to happen, what do you think the hot spots are? As I mentioned, during the Clinton administration, you had, you know, for example, welfare reform was one of the hot issues. And what do you just name one or two things that could become heated issues in the coming 4 years?
Well, we have to begin to have a serious conversation about education in urban areas. So we have to begin to see not only a broader urban policy that will speak to the circumstances of our cities, but specifically within cities, how do we address the fact that we have a generation of children being seriously educated into a certain sector of our economy. And so you have these various debates from folks who are interested in KIPP and Teach for America to folks who are interested in generating much more state-based responses as opposed to private sector responses and volunteer-based responses. So I think part of what we have to really wrap our minds around, Sister, today is that we have to begin to think about the kinds of languages we use to talk about the circumstances of black folk in this country today. I'm of the firm belief that in the era of Obama, the old vocabularies of talking about black struggle have fundamentally gone have fundamentally lost their power and purchase. And so how do we talk about urban policy without falling into the traps that we're just simply talking about black folk? And how do we talk about education policy without simply falling into the old debates and the old languages around education policy? So I think that's going to be a very important issue.
James, what about technology? Again, your group has really used technology. Do you expect this administration to try to use technology both as a way of keeping younger voters and first-time voters in the fold? And then, you know, what else could technology do on a more practical level in terms of jobs and trying to deal with things like this economic crisis?
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean, if any indication, if you look back at the way the campaign has run itself and the way it's exploited the Internet to bring people into the campaign, to build a deeper and deeper relationship with them, if they do anything like that in terms of Obama as president, I think it could be, you know, quite profound. And I also think, really, and this is something that I've kind of tried to advocate for, is that the Obama campaign take the reach that it has, that all these new voters, all these motivated people, and really help them play a role in effectively lobbying, you know, the Senate and the House, and also pushing back on Obama. I mean, what we do fundamentally, you know, we come from a particular perspective, we're focused on certain issues, but all of those folks who are looking for the kind of change Obama has talked about, they can be harnessed, and what he's done thus far in terms of the campaign could be extended to really, I think, bolster and support him as president.
Now, Sherrilyn, do you think that there is going to be a new set of leadership developing? For example, Some people have said that Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. is one of the leading contenders for the Senate seat that Senator Obama is going to be vacating. Who do we expect to be people who might have influence in talking to an Obama administration, or people who are kind of moving up in the power hierarchy? And I know this is a long question, but also what happens to the traditional, what are called the traditional civil rights leaders in this time?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because I've actually been thinking about this a lot, and I really think it's a mistake for people to think, and this is what I was saying at the top of this segment, that, you know, that Barack Obama is now ushering in a new set of leaders. I think that he's representative of a group that's already begun to rise on the scene. You know, you have one of them on the show, James Rucker, and his partner Van Jones with ColorOfChange.org, and Van even separately with his work around it, you know, the green collar economy. These are people who've already been working kind of outside the normal channels of, you know, how we see power developing, particularly in the black community, and talking about things in different ways, like talking about, you know, the green economy and so forth, and connecting that with issues of, you know, racial justice and inequity. You know, people talk about the NAACP. I think, you know, it's reinvigorated by the by Benjamin Jealous being the new director. But, you know, I look at someone like Rosalind Brooke, who's the vice chair of the board. Here's somebody really interesting, dynamic, African-American woman, very much focused on the healthcare industry, and really able to put things together in a kind of complex way, in the same way that we see Barack do. So I think that there are these people who have already been kind of out there, who are coming in at the same time that Barack Obama is becoming president, and that's what's going to make it exciting. I'm also predicting, Farai, that we're going to see in the future that there are going to be a couple of these entertainers who are going to make the transformation, maybe a John Legend. There are going to be some people who are, you know, like the old Ruben Blades, who, you know, was a great performer and then went on and ran for president in his native country in Panama. I think that some of these people who we've seen get very politicized, Kerry Washington, we're going to see them over the next 8 years perhaps make the full transformation into becoming real social justice activists with a real voice on the national scene. So I think these people are already out there, and I just think that now we're all ready to hear those voices much more, and I think we're going to see their rise on the scene. And in that sense, it's new leadership, but it's really us having an opportunity to see this new leadership operate more effectively at the national level.
All right. Well, we only have time for basically a quick chime in. But Professor Glaude, who do you see as an up-and-comer? I'm just going to ask each of you quickly. Professor Glaude first.
Cory Booker in Newark. I think he's representative of precisely the kind of new wave of leadership, not only mainstream leadership, but he's linked to the kind of interesting social background that's producing a very different kind of black voice. So I want
well,
to
James,
Cory Booker.
I have to jump in. James, just a name.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, when you talk about John Legend and Kerry Washington, I'd add the guy who works at my local post office, because what I talk about permission, people, I think, feel more ready to jump in, more personal ownership, and so I'd say all of us.
Okay. On that note, thanks. We were speaking with James Rucker of ColorOfChange.org, Sherrilyn Ifill, who is at the University of Maryland Law School, and Professor Eddie Glaude, Jr., professor at Princeton University. He spoke to us from the studios at Princeton University. And that's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show, subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, the Obama campaign masterfully mobilized the youth vote, a look at how the senator's presidential administration could keep them active.